Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee testifiers and Representative Lohmer. We do not quite yet have a quorum, so we're going to kick things off. If you would like to introduce your bill and your testifiers, House File 439, we'll go ahead and move that after we officially call the meeting to order. But if you'd like to start to describe the bill and introduce your testifiers, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and committee. House File 439 is the Prenatal Trisomy Diagnosis Awareness Act, and it is a bill that was brought to me by a mom named Heather Bradley, who's here with us today from Stillwater, and she's a mom of three beautiful daughters. Her youngest, Isabel, was born with Down syndrome. So Izzy's mom has become very involved in the Down Syndrome Diagnosis Network and asked me to sponsor a bill similar to one that has been passed in seven states to date: Massachusetts in 2012, Kentucky in 2013, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, Delaware, Ohio, and Maryland in 2014. This bill simply states that when a prenatal diagnosis is made of one of the three trisomies, 13, 18, and 21, the healthcare practitioner who orders the tests for a pregnant woman for screening purposes shall provide full and complete and up-to-date information about the trisomy conditions to the mother. The Department of Health has quality and up-to-date information on their website, and so the physician simply needs to point the pregnant mother to the website where she'll find all the information required. So we have communicated with the department, and we do actually have an amendment from the department that makes the bill totally acceptable to them, but I don't think I can move that yet, right, Mr. Chair?
Representative Lohmer, we do now have a quorum, and I'd like to officially call the meeting to order. Also, if Representative Nels Pearson moves approval of the minutes of March 18th and 19th, any additions or changes or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from the 18th and 19th, please say aye. Those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Representative Lohmer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 439.
Representative Lohmer moves House File 439 for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Sorry. 439 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. The bill's before us, and we have the A1 amendment. Representative Lohmer, please describe the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this amendment was from the department, and it happened in the Senate that they just wanted to change the language. So I don't know if anybody here wants from the department wants to discuss the reasons for that, but it's just their ideas to make the bill acceptable to the department. So,
all right, I see somebody coming forward. All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, Ms. Finnegan, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Health. The goal with the amendment is just to clarify that the language doesn't require the department to undertake any additional activities to what we do, but to do what we currently do to make information available to people in their language upon their request. This does make the bill have no cost.
All right. Are there any questions for the author, Ms. Finnegan, for the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 is adopted. The bill is before us. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So just wanted to mention a few things the bill does not do. It does not take a woman's choice or decision-making ability regarding her pregnancy. It does not preclude the physician from giving any medical advice to the patient. So this bill has the support of ARC and the Down Syndrome Association of Minnesota. It's passed in the Senate. And I have some testifiers here who would like to speak to the bill today. So,
welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go in any order that you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sandy Holmgren. Can you hear me? And here's my story. It took us, we had 6 years of infertility and had pretty much given up ever having children, and by a miracle of God, we ended up getting pregnant. I opted out for the early testing just because I didn't want to take the risks of anything happening to my baby. at 31 weeks, we ended up with a condition called polyhydramnios, which is an excessive amnio fluid. Ended up in the hospital for 15 days. During that time, they removed 5.5 liters of amnio fluid out of me and did the testing at that point. The day that the testing came back, they had called my husband and told him what the results were going to be. But before he got to the hospital, I'm in my room, and all kinds of staff came into my room, and it felt like a morgue. And the doctor walked in and said, "I am so sorry." And I was confused, didn't know what he was talking about, and proceeded to tell me that my baby was going to have Down syndrome. At that point, I fell apart. We were really upset that my husband hadn't been there, and he walked in about 5 minutes after the news came. Spent another week and a half in the hospital, where they proceeded to just throw all kinds of information at me. A lot of it was outdated, and most of it was everything that could happen to a child with Down syndrome. And at one point, you just get overwhelmed with the information because there's just so much, and you get totally depressed because, you know, it could happen. But, you know, this stuff could happen to anybody, but, you know, they're throwing it at me. At 33.5 weeks old, Michaela was born by cesarean and emergency C-section, and she was born without an esophagus and a blocked bowel. They did emergency surgery at that point and repaired everything. And then that's when they proceeded to tell me that because she was a preemie and with the conditions that she had, that she may never actually feed, that she'd always be on a feeding tube for a very long time. She was nursing before she left the NICU. They told us that she would probably never talk. If she talked, it would be a long time. She was talking at 9 months, and her first word was banana. She told us it would be 3 or 4 years possibly before she'd ever walk. She was walking at 13 months. I can tell you today, Michaela is a vibrant 20-year-old, an accomplished dancer. She choreographs her own dances and has won competitions with her dances. She's academically has excelled. She's been accepted into Bethel University's New Build program, and she is an inspiration to so many. And this is my daughter, Michaela.
Welcome to the committee, Michaela.
Hi. My name is Kayla Hayden. I am 20 years old. I attended Central Preparatory Academy, and I am currently in their social training program. I am a TA in law school. I love to golf and do gymnastics. I love to paint. My passion is dancing. And I choreograph my own music and have won laws for it. I have been accepted into Bethel and Presbyterian Build Program. I wanted to be a teacher someday.
Thank you, Michaela. Thank you for coming today.
Yeah, thank you.
And we have Heather Bradley.
Yes, I'm Heather Bradley. I'm with the Down Syndrome Diagnosis Network, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. We're an organization that supports new and expectant parents that have a Down syndrome diagnosis for their child, and we currently support over 1,300 families in our online communities.
Thank you, Ms. Bradley. And first question is from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Michaela, for being here. And, you know, I'm sorry I didn't catch the mom's name, but I heard you testify in the previous committee, and Michaela is just a beautiful young woman, and glad that you could both be here today. My question, and I'm not sure if it's for Representative Lohmer or for one of the testifiers, but when, at what point would the family find out, well, let me back up. Obviously, there could be a range of conditions and a range of impacts. So you know, I assume that some of the children that might be born with these conditions might need more extensive services. And so my question is really, at what point does the family find out what services are available, what they might need for their child, either from their own private investment or their insurance or ongoing help from the state? Because, you know, a lot of what we do is with services for people with disabilities, some of which can be more minor and time-limited, and some of which can be over a number of years that people might need assistance, including, you know, group home situations and different kinds of assistance. So how does the family begin to learn about the range of what's available to them? Is that part of what would be on the website, or is that something that the groups would give parents information about? How do you start navigating that?
Ms. Bradley.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think that's a great question. The best resource for finding that type of information is going to be the great parent groups that the Department of Health have as resources for families on the site right now. However, there's other resources that are going to be essential for these families, which are also available, which is like Help Me Grow, which is going to be something that a family really needs to be aware of even prenatally so that they can get their child signed up for services as soon as they're born. You know, for example, we had our child, getting therapy as early as 6 weeks. Had I known earlier, I would have had her earlier to have the services. But all this is great information, which just furthers the need for the bill to pass. So,
okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Michaela, just want to share with you or just give you kudos, and I'm impressed that you read your testimony from your iPhone. Shows, of course, that your young generation are smarter than some of us older folks here, and you did so well. So just wanted to let you know how impressed I was that your testimony and how you read it and prepared it. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. I just had a question for Ms. Holmgren, just to talk through a little bit from a mom's perspective, and you're walking through this, trying to get this information, and being in the hospital, and it's very confusing, and just talk about how you got your information and some of the issues that you had around that, and something that you would like to see different for other people in the same situation.
Well, like I said, after we got the information, I still had another week and a half before we actually had her. And it was actually the social worker that came in, and I mean, she would bring me literally books of information, and some of them were dated, 1957. and you start reading through it, and and that was 20 years ago, and today with the internet, it's so much easier to get that information, what you need. You can, just all of a sudden just Google it and get probably a lot more updated stuff than what I did 20 years ago. There wasn't anybody, sitting in the hospital, there wasn't anybody that really sat there and said, let me show you that, there are some good things about this. Fortunately for me, I had a sister who was a physical therapist and had worked with children with Down syndrome. So I kind of knew that there was a positive side to Down syndrome and not all the negative stuff. And but there was still a lot of, we didn't know what the future was going to hold. We knew that, number one, she was a preemie. Number one, she had some physical issues that had to be dealt with. We decided early on that she was a child first and her Down syndrome was second. So when it came to therapy and stuff, it's like, just treat her like she's a normal child and push her to, do the most work that she can. And I think parents need to know that instead of the doctors going, well, not sure if they can do this. If you give it another attitude towards it, you're going to end up a lot stronger with your children.
Thank you. And Ms. Bradley, obviously in the last 20 years, attitudes and information has changed a lot. So it seems like there's kind of two issues. One is a predisposition of staff and professionals, and the other is just the availability of good information for kind of desperate moms and dads in that situation. Can you talk maybe a little bit about the changes in the last 20 years on both the predisposition of providers as well as the amount and quality of information?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, there was a survey done, I think in the mid-2000s, 2010, where 81% of medical students reported that they were not getting any training regarding individuals with intellectual disabilities. And that's them just anonymously admitting that they're not getting any training about these conditions at all. And not only that, but we've got so much difference that have happened in the last 20 years, like you were saying. In 1980, I think the life expectancy for a person with Down syndrome was 24, and today it's 65. It's a huge difference just by treating individuals with a disability just like you would anyone else and providing them with health care like you would any other person. Adding to that, there's also been studies in 2013 on parents' experience receiving a prenatal diagnosis. 22% said they weren't provided any up-to-date information or access to support. And parents reported having a negative experience with their medical professionals by a 2.5 to 1 ratio. So just we've got this kind of two bipolar difference. We've got, really, it's never a better time to have a child with Down syndrome, yet we're still kind of hearing these experiences, both from medical professionals themselves saying, hey, we're not trained, we don't have the training, we admit we are failing here, and then also by parents saying, hey, we're not getting the information, we're having a negative experience.
Thank you. Representative Lohner, anything to wrap up?
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. I just think this is a great bill. Giving parents information and complete information is what we're after here. So thank you so much for your support.
Thank you. Representative Lohmer renews her motion that House File 439, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 439, as amended, to be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. Thank you. Representative Lohmer, Ms. Bradley, Ms. Holmgren and Michaela, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we'll have House File 980, Representative Halverson. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Would you like to move House File 980?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 980 be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Halverson moves House File 980 to be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. Representative Halverson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill deals with a few sections of law regarding rules and regulations for caregivers. 2345D was adopted back in 2012, and there have been some revisions made in the past session. And House File 980 continues those conversations regarding technical changes. As this law rolls out, questions have arisen among caregivers and others regarding how to implement some of the law, and so this is responding to those questions and providing clarification. All the stakeholders have been consulted over the past few years to create agreement and understanding around this bill, including the Department of Human Services, Disability Law Center, and others. This is fairly technical. The reason this bill is in front of this committee today is Section 18, I believe, which has to do with something that is indeed highly technical regarding payments for residential support services. There was a piece of the, I guess, 18?
Yeah.
Of this that they're removing. I will ask Barb Turner from ARM to explain why that piece is being removed from this bill.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Turner, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Barb Turner, and I'm with ARM. We represent about 150 providers of services to folks with disabilities. And the section that we're looking at that this committee has interest in was actually originally in some language having to do with the rate-setting process. And there was, at that time, some work being done on monitoring technology and how it would be used in the provision of services. And so this language is put into that piece of work as they move forward. But in actuality, the department, the language as it's written is not what the department intended or is in actuality doing in regards to monitoring technology. And so in consultation with them, their suggestion was to simply remove it. They actually have a process already in place for review of monitoring technology, very specifically when it relates to cameras being used in people's bedrooms. And so there's a process for review and approval. They never intended or do not intend at this point to review every single use of technology in providing services, because that would be a monumental task. And so that's in consultation with them, rather than trying to match what their practice is, they just felt they didn't need the language at all.
Thank you, Ms. Turner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also like to make it clear for the committee that although that this section is dealing with payments, it actually has no fiscal impact to the state, and we've confirmed that with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no takers, we will open it up to member questions. Any member questions for Representative Halverson or the testifier? Seeing none, Representative Halverson renews her motion that House File 980 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 980 is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schumacher, House File 1314.
Good job. He did, yeah.
You can do it by yourself. Welcome to the committee, Representative Schumacher. Would you like to move House File 1314?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 1314 be re-referred to the General Register.
Representative Schumacher moves House File 1314 be re-referred to the General Register. We now have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1314 is a technical correction bill that isn't as pretty as verbena, but would allow qualified University of Minnesota faculty and adjunct members who provide dental services at dental clinics owned by the university to form an agreement with the Department of Human Services and become eligible for electronic health record grants from the federal government. The intent all along was for the dental services to be provided by the university and also to have them be enrolled as an MA provider for these purposes, but because of some unclear language, the statute is not currently happening. Under this agreement, the university provider will not receive payments for services provided to MA or Minnesota Care enrollees at the university dental clinics, will not be listed in the MA or Minnesota Care directory, and is not required to service MA and Minnesota Care enrollees when providing non-volunteer services in private practice. The language is to ensure that this agreement is really to utilize the electronic health record grants. With me today is Mr. Jeffrey Ogden, Chief Administrative Officer for the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota, who can answer your questions.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ogden. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ogden. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the School of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly to this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Schumacher for carrying this bill on behalf of our institution. We've been working with the Department of Human Services for 2 years to access funding available to us and other schools across the country under the Affordable Care Act. This clarification allows us to move forward with an application that is very concise and well documented, and we have discussed this clarification with both the Board of Dentistry and the Department of Human Services and anyone else that we can find, and we find no opposition to this clarification. It does not change the scope of practice for our practitioners at all. They are already doing all of the acts that with regard to patients. It only applies to the School of Dentistry, so it's very narrow. It has no cost to the state. This is strictly flow-through funding that goes to the School of Dentistry. And as I said previously, other schools across the United States, from Massachusetts to Texas, have already accessed this funding, so we are not blazing any new trails. I am happy to answer any questions, and we hope we can have your support.
Thank you, Mr. Ogden. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll close the testimony portion and open it up to member questions. Are there members questions for the author or for Mr. Ogden regarding the bill? Seeing no questions, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House Bill 1314 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 1314 is recommended to be referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Mr. Ogden, Representative Schumacher, you also have House File 921. Would you like to move House File 921?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that House File 921 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Representative Schumacher moves House File 921 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. We have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 921 establishes a new way for people to save for their long-term care needs. In the the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee, we've heard a lot of discussion about long-term care insurance and some of the different products and the lack of products that are out there. This is one solution. It came from the Nebraska legislature, actually, and how they established a different form for people to be able to save for themselves. Essentially, it's a health savings account, but you don't have to have a qualified health insurance plan to go with it, and it provides for state tax shelter for savings of up to $1,000 a year so that people are able to use the funds that they save on their own to provide for their own long-term care in the future and use those funds for that so they can make decisions based on where they want to stay on their own. There is no health tests or anything else that are required of it. If you're a Minnesota citizen, you can sign up and utilize it. MMB is established as the state agency that would overlook what they're doing here, and with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no takers. Representative Schumacher, could you talk about the cost of this is going to be carried in taxes? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's why it's going to taxes next.
All right. And this is from Nebraska, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They implemented this back in 2007, and it was for the same reasons that we would be doing it today, trying to establish more options for people to be able to save.
Is Nebraska unicameral, Representative Schumacher?
The last time I checked, Mr. Chair, yes it is.
And it's also the home of Verbena, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Verbena is quite popular down there. Okay. And very, very pretty.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Nebraska is also the home of Representative Kim Norton.
Ah, excellent.
Also lovely.
Wait a minute.
You're going to learn something here whether you like it or not. Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, we heard this in the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee, and appreciate that you're looking around for creative ways to help impact this problem that we all know is coming. But my question to you is there anything in this bill to help us evaluate whether this works? Because this is going to be something that is going to impact, if it makes it into law, if it gets into the tax bill, but if it makes it into law, it's going to cost something. And and that might be very well worth it if it actually impacts the problem. But are we building in some evaluation here so that we're going to be able to know whether people are using it, whether it's actually looks like it's on track to help do what it's supposed to do?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. The current language does not have any kind of report back or evaluation method, but I'd definitely be open to making changes to reflect that.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schumacher, you've probably heard me say this before, but there is a provision in law concerning tax bills. New tax bills are supposed to have a purpose statement and some kind of way of measuring their impact. And so I would really appreciate it if you would give that some thought between now and when it hits the floor so that we can have a fighting chance to make sure that we can keep the things that work and then get rid of the things that cost money but don't work so that we can, you know, obviously all of us want to use our money in the best way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Schumacher regarding House File 921? Seeing none, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 921 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 921 is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Next in your packet, I just have a really quick technical thing. This is House File 1606. I'm going to go ahead and just move that from here. House File 1606 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. And I'm going to ask Mr. Berg to just very quickly describe the technical aspects of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, what you see in House File 1606 is actually a proposal by the Department of Human Services. It's part of the governor's budget bill. It, as you'll see, deletes a provision in law that allows the commissioner to transfer money between the medical assistance account, which is the account in the general fund where medical assistance allocations are, and the home and community-based services transition grants account, which is an account in 2013. There was a department and governor's initiative that passed that provided funding for transitioning individuals from settings at the Security Hospital and Anoka Regional Treatment Center, I believe, to home and community-based settings. At the time, the department thought it was a good idea to have authority to move money between those accounts, although if you look earlier, you'll see that the individuals don't necessarily qualify for MA. In any case, this has never been used. The department has never transferred funds between those accounts and decided that for clarity and to make sure things were where they belong, that they would just delete this authority. It has, as I say, has never been used and has no impact on the commissioner's ability to run this program.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, is there any questions from members regarding this bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1606 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. House File 1606 is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. And next we have the Governor's Supplemental Budget Presentation. And if we could have Dave Greenman and Commissioner Jessen please come forward. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner and Mr. Greenman. Please introduce yourself for the record. And I believe we have it information in the packets. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services.
And my name is Dave Greenman. I'm the Budget Director with the Department of Health. Thank you for having us here today to go through the governor's supplemental budget proposals. The first proposal invests $1.2 million per year from the general fund to strengthen the statewide safe harbor program for youth who have been sexually exploited. This is part of a joint proposal with the Department of Human Services that provides a total of $2 million for increased funding for safe harbor. Safe harbor uses a multi-agency, multidisciplinary approach to address the plight of sexually exploited youth, recognizing that they are actually victims of crime rather than perpetrators. The program uses a no-wrong-door policy involving educators, healthcare providers, law enforcement officials, and social service networks to bring these youth into the Safe Harbor program for appropriate support and services. The current MDH budget for Safe Harbor is approximately $1.5 million per year, which covers the cost of grants for regional navigators, trauma-informed culturally appropriate services, as well as operating costs. The Department of Health has awarded regional navigator grants to eight organizations throughout the state that serve as the main points of contact for sexually exploited youth and for professionals who engage with sexually exploited or at-risk youth. Navigators are key to the success of the Safe Harbor program and of the No Wrong Door policy, providing direct support and services, case consultation, and building regional capacity to address the needs of youth. However, currently regional navigators are spread very thin throughout the state. Some serve areas as large as 22 counties. This proposal would provide funding to sustain the existing 8 navigators and increase the number of navigators from 8 to 12. The success of the state of the Safe Harbor model and the No Wrong Door model depends on training for frontline professionals in healthcare, law enforcement, education, and social services in other fields to identify and appropriately interact with youth who've been sexually exploited. Just as important is the need to implement protocols for that the professionals can use when they're dealing with these youth and working with them through the legal system and the education system and getting them into the appropriate resources. What this proposal would do is sustain the current number of regional navigators we have, increase the number of navigators, implement protocols for responding to sexually exploited youth, and train professionals to interact with these youth.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. If you'd like to, maybe we've got plenty of time to walk through it, and I see we're still handing some stuff out. So, how many sections do you think you might have for folks and for questions to go through?
Mr. Chair, I just have 2 to walk through, and we have a couple of technical changes, but those are very minor.
Okay. Why don't we just go through the changes, and then if people have questions, we can come back.
Sure. In the second proposal, the governor recommends investing about $1.5 million per year from the general fund to maintain existing protections for vulnerable adults in healthcare settings. Approximately 36,000 vulnerable adults receive care in facilities such as nursing homes, boarding care homes, and supervised living facilities. The department protects the health and safety of these individuals through enforcing state licensing laws, enforcing federal Medicaid and Medicare laws, and enforcing the State Vulnerable Adults Act. Important aspects of our work include unannounced on-site surveys to identify issues of concern and investigations of allegations of maltreatment. As we come forward with this proposal, it's important to note that the vast majority of the providers in the state provide high-quality services that improve the quality of life for residents. However, in 2013, the department issued over 2,300 survey deficiencies to nursing homes, as well as hundreds of deficiencies to other facility types in the state. In that same year, the department received 19,270 reports of alleged abuse, neglect, and maltreatment in healthcare facilities. Funding for the department's work in regulating healthcare facilities is split approximately 40% Medicare, 40% Medicaid, and approximately 20% from state sources. Currently, the state share, including the cost of enforcing the Vulnerable Adults Act, is funded through fees to nursing homes, boarding care homes, supervised living facilities, hospitals, and other providers. Fees for the vulnerable adults enforcement costs have not been increased since 1995. Since then, over that time, the cost of the enforcement has increased significantly as the number and types of providers who are subject to the law have increased, as well as the number of complaints requiring response from the department. Since 2001, the number of allegations of maltreatment made to the department have increased 544%. The department has been able to sustain operations by increasing efficiencies and by targeting investigations to allegations that involve actual harm. However, this approach is no longer sustainable. Another primary driver of rising costs is the cost of licensing state-owned and operated facilities. The department currently licenses veterans homes and state-owned hospitals and treatment centers. However, we receive no funding to cover these costs. Without additional support, the department would not have the resources to adequately respond to allegations of maltreatment under the Vulnerable Adults Act. Starting in fiscal year 16, this proposal would provide an additional $1,152,000 to support Vulnerable Adult Act enforcement costs and $362,000 a year for regulation of state-operated facilities. Providing the general fund support for the vulnerable adults enforcement recognizes both the burden that a fee increase would have on these providers as well as the broad public benefit from protecting the safety, dignity, and health of our most vulnerable citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Grumman. Commissioner Jess.
Mr. Chair, members, I have five proposals that really modify or change in some significant way proposals that are originally in the governor's January budget, and then 11 new proposals. So I thought I would perhaps, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, members, go through the significantly revised proposals in overview first, and then I will dive into the new proposals unless you'd like me to take it in the opposite order.
No, I think that's the best way.
The first significantly revised proposal deals with child protection oversight. Originally, the governor's budget proposed additional funding of about $2.5 million for the Department of Human Services, and the governor's proposed budget would add an additional $50 million to that. It would fund about $22 million per year for county staffing. Since the task force's preliminary recommendations in December, there was a county-state work group that analyzed what the projected cost to county governments would be to comply, for the human services staff to comply with the initial recommendations for the governor's task force. It would fund those costs, as well as $3 million a year for grants for culturally specific services to help reduce disparities in our child welfare system. So that would be the child protection oversight. I'll move on, Mr. Chair. And
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm just wondering, since an expected outcome of the revisions to the system that were needed, and thank you for working with the task force and others on this, is likely to result in some additional out-of-home placement, some additional need for treatment and follow-up with the families. Is that included in this, or is this more the initial investigation response funding?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, these additional dollars do two things. I mean, it is really the what the counties have told us are their costs for being able to comply with the initial recommendations from the task force. The task force made initial recommendations and some pretty substantial ones at the end of December, and now we're just adopted kind of the full set of recommendations, and we'll be issuing a report to the governor and legislature later this month. So it does not fund all of the recommendations, but it does fund the county human services part of those initial ones, as well as grant funding, which we would administer through an RFP process to fund evidence-based practices, which we really believe will address some of the disparities and do more early intervention.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Jess.
Moving on, Mr. Chair, the governor proposes to delay the closure of the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Hospital in Willmar. The original proposal had CABS closing in December of this year. It would delay that for 6 months. In talking with stakeholders in the Willmar community, we believe more time is needed to either create the hospital beds or replace this to make sure that we have a transition from this facility and to engage further conversations with the Willmar community. There's actually a savings of this for of $1.4 million from the governor's original proposed budget in 16 and 17 because of the delay in the severance pay. I will just continue on.
Well, just on that, Commissioner Jessen, what is the next step for that? If we're delaying it for 6 months, do we have any more better information from the department on guidance for that?
Mr. Chair, we're having discussions, very active discussions with providers about their willingness to provide contract beds to care for these children with very, very complex needs and the circumstances. And we would need to make sure that a private provider who may be willing to do this, but we need to make sure that if a provider agrees to do that, that they then don't demit those kids, that if they're accepting them and to treat them. I mean, what we see that some of the children with very high needs that are in our CABS facilities often come to CABS from another hospital. And so we need to, so we have very active discussions around that. and we hope to know more soon. But we think that delaying this will give us time to make sure that as we make this transition, that no child is without the treatment they need.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know there was a lot of confusion around that when we had testimony in committee, and I just want to make sure that before the budget is closed out that we have guidance over that budget and plan for that through the biennium from our standpoint. I think that's the committee's understanding.
And that's what I want to do as well, Mr. Chair. The third item is increased capacity for individuals with complex conditions. Mr. Chair, if I may go back to the CAPS for one moment. I believe that in the original packet you received the incorrect budget page on the CAPS, and that we provided the committee with the correct one. So I just wanted to let you know that. On the increased capacity, as you all will probably recall in the original governor's budget proposal, the governor proposed opening three additional facilities, and this really addresses the need for hospital beds, particularly with very challenging patients with mental illness, some whom are having to wait in line to get into ANOCA. So the governor's budget originally proposed opening an additional highly specialized ERTS in 2016, and then two other CBHHs. These are subacute psychiatric hospitals in 18 and 19. Our discussions with the the hospital association, with communities around the state, has all been we need beds sooner. And our thought is that we need to be able to get people into ANOCA that are on those waiting lists, and that means we need to get people out of ANOCA who shouldn't be there. So this proposal includes opening up 11 additional hospital beds at our CBHHs. So this is, and we can do that very quickly because we have the beds there. We just don't have the staff to provide the staffing. So this would be an additional cost of, I believe it is, $3.9 million in the next biennium to open up 11 additional hospital beds. The transitions initiative flexibility, the original proposal included transitions from mental health facilities and was budget neutral. This has a budget cost because one of the challenges we saw that there were individuals, particularly at ANOCA Regional Treatment Center and some insecurity hospital in the CBHHs, that were kind of stuck there where they no longer really needed that hospital level of care, but we struggled to move them into the community, and so this would allow them to access the elderly waiver with a higher monthly budget cap so that we can be serving those individuals in the community instead of having them take up hospital beds unnecessarily, and obviously then they would be able to be in the community, which is where most of them would be. That would be an additional $1.5 million in 16-17. Finally, there are changes proposed in the governor's supplemental budget to the Consolidated CD Treatment Fund, and this is really to extend the closing of both CARE Carlton and CARE Fergus Falls. So it would extend the closing from CARE Carlton to July 1st of this year and extend the closing of CARE Fergus Falls from June 30th, 2016 to January 1, 2017. We have been having a lot of active conversations with stakeholders. We put out an RFI to kind of see what interest there was and capacity within the private provider community to care for many of the clients that we now serve through our CARE program. And this is really our effort at CARE to make sure that the CARE beds are there for those who need it, the people who really need the safety net, as opposed to those who could be served in private facilities. And it also includes an increased dollar amount per diem for those, whether you're in kind of the CARE or the private or the most complex clients. So this would, we need some additional time, we believe, to be able to have that additional discussion and planning between DHS and community providers, and also to allow the community providers time to apply for certification to get this new rate, which is proposed in the governor's budget. So this would actually have a overall zero budget neutral in 16-17 because we're spending more funds from one fund, less from the other. But I wanted to make sure I brought that to your attention. So, Mr. Chair, I'll dive into the new proposals.
Please proceed, Commissioner Jessen.
So our first new proposal deals with our EMFIP grants. That's the Economic Stability for Families proposal. And that would mean that under the governor's proposed budget, effective this October, our EMFIP cash grant would increase by $100 per month per eligible family. I think you all probably recall my talking about just how many children we have living in deep poverty. 70% of those served by our EMFIP grants are children. And that's why the governor thinks that this is particularly important to bring more children out of deep poverty. The Homeless Youth Act is the next proposal. And I know that most of you all are very well aware that the legislature adopted and made a good start on the Homeless Youth Act in 2013, I believe it was. But we didn't finish the work. And we still have a lot of youth that are without housing in our state. And this would propose an additional $2 million in the next biennium to provide housing and services to homeless youth throughout Minnesota. The next provision Mr. Greenman already really talked about, because it's jointly something we work on with the Department of Health, and that is additional funding for our safe harbor for sexually exploited youth. I think Mr. Greenman kind of talked about how the program works overall. The Department of Health provides navigator services, regional navigators, and we have services for shelter and, you know, housing, some of the supportive services, and this would provide DHS $1.6 million in additional dollars for the safe harbor law in the next biennium. The next item, Mr. Chair, members, relates to grants for reducing the incidence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And these are additional dollars to help pregnant, there are about 1 in 13 pregnant women who use alcohol, during their pregnancy. And so this is really trying to provide those comprehensive services for pregnant and parenting women to reduce the incidence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and other prenatal drug-related effects in children. This would continue the funding for a successful project, the CRAFT program in Olmsted County, as well as provide funding to support similar programs in two additional counties. We think this works meshes well with what we're trying to do in another governor's budget proposal to provide more comprehensive services to women who are at high risk, especially opioids. This really deals with what is the problem around Minnesota, and that's the use of alcohol as well as some other drugs. So this would provide about $1 million in additional grant funding for the next biennium. Next, Mr. Chair, members, the governor proposes funding the ABLE accounts. As I think most of you all are aware, the federal government in 2014 passed the ABLE Act, which allows states to establish accounts for people with disabilities to save private funds to supplement public benefits. This is, in some ways, there's to operate kind of like 529 college plans that some of us who have put too many children through college have relied upon. And this would really, proposal would have funding for DHS to contract with an outside entity to manage the ABLE's accounts, and the funding to DHS would be $105,000 to basically manage that contract, though by fiscal year 18 it would be budget neutral because we'd be using some of those annual service fees that were charged to account members. But we really estimate that between 30 and 50,000 people may be eligible to have an ABLE account, so we want to get this up and running. The next proposal is a supportive housing pay-for-performance proposal. This is as budget neutral. But this is a proposal, if those of you who remember back to 2011, there was a bill passed which enabled the state to look at, some people called it social impact bonds, others pay-for-performance. So what this proposes is to deal with the challenges of individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities or mental illness. We're not living in that most integrated setting, so we want to use this Pay for Performance Act to create a pilot that transitions people from who are able and willing from kind of our MSOCs homes, our group homes and state-operated services, as well as adult foster care, into supportive housing in the community. And, the pilot would move about 100 people over 3 years, we project, and the savings that are realized in the forecast would be used to pay back investors under this model. So this is, I think, the first time a state agency has tried to take advantage of this. We're excited about that, and that is that's why we put it in the governor's supplemental budget. Next, employer contributions for permanently disabled employees. Some of our DHS staff have, in direct care and treatment, and I know many of you all are aware of this, have incredibly difficult jobs. Some of our employees that work at Security Hospital, at Anoka, at some of our MSOCs homes. And there are assaults against our employees that occur in these places. These are difficult and sometimes clients with that are public safety threats, and that's why they are in our facilities. And we've had a small number of employees that have become totally and permanently disabled as a result. And this proposal seeks to provide stability and care to those in state employees by providing the employer's share of health insurance. So with a small dollar amount, but we think it is an important thing to do for our employees. This would be, start out, we project about $17,000 in fiscal year 17, go up to $34,000 in fiscal year 18, and $51,000 in fiscal year 19. Next item, Mr. Chair, members, is relates to managed care audits. I think it was just a week or two ago I was here talking with you, with Mr. Nobles, about the OLA's report. And one of the recommendations of the OLA was that increased audits by DHS of MCO expenses on a much more real-time basis. And I think, as Mr. Noble suggested then, is that it is difficult because of the potential conflicts with plans. He recommended that we develop this expertise in-house. So this proposal provides additional, would provide additional funding for audit and financial staff and a state and a small state contract to conduct these ad hoc audits of MCOs. So it would include looking at the, how administrative costs are allocated, the appropriateness of administrative costs, the validation of administrative and medical expenses that are provided for our rate-setting purposes, the validation of documentation and contracts, and this proposal would impact all managed care organizations. It would cost about $680,000 in the next biennium, and then it comes down a little. We expect some savings in the following biennium. These auditors would be in our internal audit department, though they would work closely with experts in our healthcare administration. Next, Mr. Chair, members, would be the establishment, one-time funding for the establishment of a Minnesota Task Force on Healthcare Financing. Starting in 2017, Minnesota, like other states, have the ability to propose an alternative framework for insurance affordability programs to the federal government. On what they call the state innovation waivers. And we think that it's not like a magic ticket. You have to show that it's going to be no more expensive to the enrollees of the federal government than the existing programs, but it really gives us a chance to look at how we could do things differently and better here than in Minnesota. The Affordable Care Act has provided steps forward in many ways, but also, you know, there are some ways that you could say there's some things we're doing well in Minnesota before it passed and sometimes better. This really gives us the opportunity to say, what do we want our healthcare system to look like? And to leverage federal dollars to do that. And it would also, the governor wants this, wants to have broad participation in looking at what that roadmap would look like. And as part of that, to look at what we should be doing with our healthcare exchange moving forward. And I think there's been some, you know, press around this, but the governor believes that to do this right, we need to fund it. We need to make sure we have the actuaries, we have the experts to look at these different scenarios and help the task force make good recommendations to come back to the legislature with by January 2016. This would also look at kind of our Minnesota Care program as well as MA and MNsure. So that would be, under the governor's proposal, $500,000 in fiscal year 16. Almost through, Mr. Chair, members. The last is a very important one. It's our nursing facility workforce enhancement proposal. I think all of you, and certainly Representative Schumacher is particularly aware of this, our nursing homes are having a lot of difficulty keeping direct care workers and competing with other employers for workers. And competition is particularly a challenge when you're near hospitals or other major community employers, and some nursing facilities have had to limit admissions just because of these workforce challenges. So this proposal would recommend a one-time operating payment rate increase for nursing facilities within a set appropriation, nursing facilities could ask for that rate increase, and it would apply both to the medical assistants and private pay residents, which I think is important. We would make those funding decisions based upon local market conditions. So the proposal would cover costs for labor market data evaluation that would be part of a review. So this would really enable us to look at the different needs in different parts of the state. Because labor conditions are very different in different parts, and I think we need to be more nuanced about this. But we estimate that up to a total of about 50,000 workers in the nursing facility system might be impacted by this, but we also recognize that this does not mean that every employee would get a raise. But it would give us the ability to make these rate increases based upon local market conditions. So under the governor's proposal, because it would take us some time to get this up and running, we would want to start this in January 2016. That would be $7.7 million in fiscal year 16 and $17 million approximately in fiscal year 17. So that, Mr. Chair, members, is my very high-level overview. I'm happy to answer questions, and I have a lot of staff if you want to dive into the details who are here as well.
Thank you so much, Commissioner and Mr. Greenman, for going through the information. It's a lot of detail and a lot of things to go through, and the changes and the new proposals for the governor's supplemental budget. Do members have questions to start off for the commissioner, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Couple things I want to focus on. One is the task force that the governor is recommending, and I am glad to see. We've had some pretty good success with task forces, I think, and it's a matter of getting the right people together and really thinking about things, and that's great. I'm just would like a little more detail, though, about the appropriation that he's asking for this, because, you know, it's just a round number. I realize that it's kind of arbitrary, but I'd like to understand a bit better how you would expect to spend that money or how the governor would expect that money to be spent. And then my other question, well, I'll let you answer that one.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't have all the details right in front of me at this time. I'm happy to get those to you and the committee. But based on my recollection as we put these together, one, we thought that it would be particularly important to have a facilitator. We found that, you know, if you have a good facilitator who has some expertise in this area, especially because we really want to bring together a robust group of people from very different perspectives, and we estimated, based upon our past experience, that that would be about $100,000. We also wanted to make sure that we had actuarial expertise to be, you know, clearly the numbers that, you know, that were relied upon in, you know, 2012, 2013, when we didn't know what the reality was. We need to revisit those numbers and those actuarial estimates, and actuaries are not cheap. The task force might decide they want these experts to look at a couple of different scenarios. So we wanted to make sure that that we had the experts available to provide that information. So that was a large chunk of the money. There was some cost for department staff, but most of this is just going to outside experts, especially actuaries, that we thought the task force might be important for the task force to access.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Commissioner. So I'm kind of boiling that down to we need help to understand, make sure we know what we're talking about as we're talking about different proposals, and then maybe some help talking to each other.
so that we can all work together and come up with something. And I think those are a couple of great goals, and I hope we can do something along those lines. My other question is about the appropriation to do the auditing. And I saw this term in the bill that I just filed and that many members are co-authors on, to implement the OLA's report. They use the term ad hoc auditing, which kind of is sort of a new term to me. But and I'm glad to see the governor proposing to fund this, because I think this is really, really important. And I just wonder if you could give us a little more of a sense of, actually, it seems like a lot of money on the one hand. I was actually surprised you could do it with so few people. But I wonder if you could just give us a little more of a sense of why this number of FTEs, who you've got now, and who these people are, because I think it's important for the committee to sort of understand the depth of expertise that these people need. Because I don't, from what I understand, this is not a job that you can take somebody out of school and say, go and audit, please. This is takes some real depth of experience and is kind of a high-level job.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that is exactly right. This would include FTEs plus, I believe it was, I'm trying to look at the change page, but I believe it was a $150,000 contract. So we could contract for some of this. But based on our conversations with the OLA, what they really imparted to us is you need to develop this expertise in-house. If you rely only on contractors, especially with the conflict, you may get somebody up to speed, and then they go, you know, and then they're gone. And that this is really a highly specialized area. You know, I did ask if Mr. Nobles would like to just let us hire some of his employees that he'd gotten this from doing the initial audit. He didn't seem very enthusiastic about that. But I do we have anyone here who, if you like, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I have Assistant Commissioner Nathan Morocco who can come in and give you more details on this, or I can forward that to you, whichever you would prefer.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have the time, I'd like to hear from
you. We've got several other members with questions, and we got a little less than a half hour.
So at your pleasure, Mr. Chair, if you, I can always get the information.
We'd be happy to have him come down. Please introduce yourself for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Morocco, Assistant Commissioner, and we would be happy to provide a more detailed list. I really think the commissioner did do a good job of overviewing it. In essence, the ad hoc process is more, we would describe it more as real time. I think we would still anticipate some retrospective analysis done by the legislative auditor, which is, you know, after the fact, looking back at history, you know, how did the system perform? Did the rate setting process work? I think this is really intended to be more real time, which is as the information comes in, are we getting the accurate information that we need? Is how information is classified or categorized? So when they talk about admin expenses, medical expenses, you know, how they choose to allocate those dollars, are those really being represented accurately at the time that we're setting the rate, so that if there is a discrepancy, we can have those very informed discussions as part of that process, but still having the retrospective analysis from somebody like the OLA to really help us inform whether, you know, how that process is working. And again, be happy to provide more details, I understand.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Jessen, in regards to the MFIT proposal of $100 more, so we all, you know, share in the mission to help those in poverty meet their basic needs, they can live in dignity and achieve, you know, their highest potential. I'm just curious, and I just want to compliment the group, the advocacies who have advocated for that $100 increase to their $532 cash assistance that hasn't been raised since 1986, in so much the fact that I think they were very, and I said this to the folks that met with me, very admirable and honorable that they asked for only $100. You know, around this place, you ask for $10 million, you hope you get two. They asked for $100. It's very humble.
Again, I'll reiterate, very admirable, I think, and I told the folks that. But I did ask a question in my office, but they didn't have an answer. I'm curious on a couple things. One, I see that in the budget, the supplemental budget, that we have other grants that we have enacted as a legislature to help lift people out of poverty. So to say that they haven't had an increase since 1932 is a fact, but what other, 86, excuse me, what other programs have we enacted to indeed help folks live in dignity and lift them up out of poverty, such as child care assistance, helping with the payment of rent, and other programs such as technical activities and DWP grants and such and so forth. So other areas that we indeed show our concern and generosity. You know, when you just on the basis say we haven't increased the MFIT grant since 1986, you would think that we're cold-hearted and we don't care. We obviously know that's not the truth, because there are other programs that we've had that compound with that to help them live in dignity. So just curious if you can respond to that. And then also in the in your budget, in the governor's budget, it mentions bringing children out of poverty or even homelessness. Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this monies go to the families, not children. Obviously, it does all. It hopefully helps with the children. But I see it says that you want to end homelessness of children and bring children out of poverty. But it really is the families is what we want to help. And the result would be hopefully lifting children out of poverty. So.
Commissioner Justin.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. Couple of things. Yes, we think the best way, one of the best ways to help children is to help their families. 70% of the people on MFIP are children, and making sure they have a safe place to live is really central to this. You know, I understand what you're saying, and I think about the things that we do as a state to support children and families. I think that a couple of the things that you've mentioned that we haven't done as well on is like our child care assistance. You know, we do provide that, but those are things that we haven't, you know, increased that in a significant way for a long time either. I think the biggest thing that we've done, and this is mostly through federal dollars, that is to increase since for the last 30 years has been SNAP or SNAP benefits. So we certainly they are significantly more than they were 30 years ago. But I think the huge gap, which you're trying to address here, is really about housing. If you think about it, $532 a month doesn't really pay rent, or maybe just barely, you know, for a family. And so that's, we've seen, you know, housing costs go up and up and up. And yes, we have given more money through SNAP for some food, but we have not been able, we don't pay enough for families to really basically have housing. And that's why I think increasing the grant at this time is so important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, then, just in reading this, this change will help address the growing number of children who are homeless. I mean, increasing the $100, if they're homeless, how do they get it? I'm playing on words here. I think, you know, please explain that maybe just for clarification. If they're homeless, how do they don't have an address. I mean, how do you help them? It's really the families. So I'm just, and I'll end it right there. Just I'll let you speak.
Commissioner Jess.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald. You know, we do have families on assistance who are homeless. You know, and by raising the amount assistance pays, we hope to get more of them into homes. I think one of the saddest statistics for me, and I know I've shared this with several of you, is that of, you know, when we did look at the Wilder homeless count, you know, 46%, almost half of the people who are homeless on any given night are children and youth, kids under 21. And so I think this is one of the most effective ways we can do to try and address that.
Representative Murphy.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank you for helping me identify that and be more knowledgeable on it.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm grateful that you're here, and I'm going to follow up a little bit, I think, on what Representative McDonald started. And I am hoping that you can maybe just step out of the budget pages a little bit and help the committee understand what the administration is hoping to achieve with this part of the state's budget in the next couple of years as it's proposed.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think the governor's supplemental budget really builds upon kind of the themes I talked about earlier, which is, and our priorities from the Department of Human Services, which I think very much fit the governor's overall priorities, we need to do more to help children and families, especially those kids that are living in deep poverty. And that's what I think kind of the MFIP proposal is one of the key parts of that, you know, in combination with looking at, you know, our basic sliding fee and a number of the other changes, you know, that we proposed in the governor's original budget. So really trying to address the needs of vulnerable children. And that's why kind of things like the Homeless Youth Act or the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth. And, you know, reaching out and helping those mothers who are addicted or using alcohol when they're pregnant so that their children are born hopefully without, you know, exposure to that and they don't end up in our child protection system. And obviously the $50 million addition for our child protection system so that we can do a better job for children and who are their most vulnerable and that we have the most responsibility for that are in our child welfare system. So that, I think, is kind of front and center for the governor and for me as commissioner, and I think these proposals help further that. And I think that some of the additional kind of delays of the closures and also really go to a second huge priority, which is our mental health system and bolstering that. We need to make some changes in direct care and treatment, but we need to make them in a careful, thoughtful way and to make sure that we, as we make necessary changes, we're not hurting people as we do that and as we try and move to a better system.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for that. And I also note that you're with the task force, the administration is thinking about the healthcare delivery system of our future. And I'm wondering if you could just shed just a little more light on that as well for us.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think when our state is clearly a leader in the healthcare system, we're rated the best performing healthcare, the state with the best performing healthcare system in the country last summer. And that's well deserved. But I think one of the ways we got there, kind of the turning points, were where we brought people together, people from Republicans and Democrats and experts in the field and consumers, and said, okay, here we are, but we're not satisfied. How do we move forward? We did that, you know, with Minnesota Care. We did that in 2008. I mean, there are a number of these times where we've really, brought people together to take that long-term view. And that is really what the governor is hoping we do here. We have opportunities from the federal government. We have some challenges at the state. And a lot of questions, including those about where we should go with Minsure. But so we shouldn't just solve, we need to solve problems, but we need to do that, recognizing that in our healthcare system, it all fits together. You can't kind of, if you deal only with one issue in isolation, something else falls apart. And that's why I think really collectively looking at the system with the experts is so important. Mr. Chair, may I add one priority to that?
Absolutely.
My earlier answer to Representative Murphy. I do want to note how delighted I am that the governor's supplemental budget includes a mechanism for addressing what I think are very real concerns in our nursing facilities around, around workforce. And I know it's a different proposal, both in scope and in type, than Representative Schumacher. I think that there are a lot of good ideas around where we ought to be going, but I'm just delighted that we have an approach here that I think it would help meet what is a very real need.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted, just to have sort of a working framework from the commissioner as we begin the process of setting the budget. And, of course, you and I have done hard work together, and we're going to do some more hard work in this committee. As I told you earlier, I brought you the Tums in case, we get any heartburn, we can share them with the committee.
I need more than that.
In all good spirit, I know that we're going to do the next bunch of weeks are going to be tough here. And I know that we're going to have disagreements. And I hope that at the end of the process that we are, thinking comprehensively about a system for the future. And, I'll do my darndest to help shape that. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner Justin. See, You know, I got a couple questions. First one has to deal with homeless children and families, which probably caused a lot of despondency in all of us, including Minnesotans in general, when you hear family, children, and the word homeless all in one sentence. But one of the things I am aware of is in Illinois, they did a audit of their, you know, of their government programs of people who receive benefits, and they hired an outside vendor, you're probably aware of it, in 2012, and they found that in Illinois, 8,000 dead people were somehow signed up for programs and receiving Illinois benefits, okay, as if thousands of others were basically trying to scam the system. So they hired an outside vendor to audit their system, and they found, it's still up in the air a little bit, somewhere between a $75 and $200 million savings. My question is, what are we doing to keep people from scamming the system here in Minnesota? And also, I'm a co-author on a bill this session that would require hiring an outside vendor to audit our systems. Because when I look at $75 to $200 million, and who knows what it is in Minnesota, that could help a lot of homeless children and families without raising taxes.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenhagen, let me share with you some of the things that we are doing and that we've started doing more of in the last several years, because I think we are in a different situation than Illinois. And I don't have it right in here, the whole list of things, but I would RAC audits. So we actually, in the last 2 years, started contracting with outside auditors to go in and, you know, look at our Medicaid payments. We're starting with hospitals, but that's where a lot of our Medicaid patient clients' payments go to. So we've hired these outside auditors to go in and, you know, identify where they think that there's, you know, and it's not always fraud. Sometimes it's just wrong payments. So that's a lot of it. But it's but payments that were wrong, that were not justified, and recovering them. And the auditors in those cases, they only get paid a percentage of what's actually recovered. I think last year we had $2 million and attributed to this that goes back to the general fund, not to DHS, as a result of those audits. We also, in 2013, one of our pitches to the legislature, which we all funded, which we're very grateful for, was to add more audit staff, to beef up our Office of Inspector General. So, and as part of that, one of the things we do is do a lot more. We hired some people with data analytics specialties so that we have the data analytics capacity to be able to run checks before and say, is there anyone who's dead, who's on our program? Is there anyone who is excluded and shouldn't be providing services that's on our program? So we do a lot of that on the front end. Representative Greenhagen, I'm happy to just give you kind of, this is what just some of the parts I remember, sure, to give you a more comprehensive list. But I do think there is a role at times for outside auditors, and where we've seen it, we've asked for the authority, gotten it from the legislature, and we're doing some of that.
Thank you. Representative Greenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response. You know, when you hear news reports that a couple's living on a yacht in Florida collecting Minnesota welfare benefits, it does get a little bit disconcerting. So do you believe that what they did in Illinois would be helpful, or do you think we have adequate, and no system's going to be perfect.
No system.
Okay, I understand that. Do you think we have adequate safeguards and checks and balances in place based on the comments that you've just made?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me just first out and say, absolutely, I agree with you. And find out people are living on a yacht, and that's incredibly troubling, which is why we've taken these additional steps to try and beef things up our enforcement in the last few years. I don't know enough about what they did in Illinois to really be able to comment on that. I'll look into that. I do think we've made a lot of progress, but as you said, no system's always perfect. You can always improve, and that's why we try and use our data analytics. Where do we think something's going wrong? Where are red flags? And then go after them. So I think we're always open to improvement.
Thank you. Representative Greenhagen. Last question.
Then my other question is on the task force, the $500,000. $1 million study. I appreciate the intent of it. I'm going to give you a goal of Jim Nobles put out at one of the committees I was on. He was given $1.7 million to do an audit of the MCOs, and he figured out how to do it for $100,000 and is in a position to give $1.6 million back to the legislature. Now, if that's the standard, that's about 6% of the money we gave him. So if I look at the $500,000, I would say we give you 6%, $30,000. You should be able to do a pretty good job with it if you use the noble standard, okay? Second thing, I'll volunteer to be on the committee, and there's a tremendous amount of evidence that state exchanges are not doing well in general, and states have canceled them. And I think Minnesota's exchange has been a classic example of something that's tried to be kept afloat. And I think the solution is private sector reforms. It's what brought our gas price down, not government. It's what can bring our health care costs down and increase access. So when you're looking at this task force, are you going to look at private sector reforms versus just more government, which is, in my opinion, going to make things worse and not better?
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor wants a task force, really, of experts and people with very different perspectives, and I think take a broad look at the options. So that would not just mean government-driven, but it would mean private sector, driven reforms. I think this is the idea of this task force is to get the people and the expertise in the room to look at a number of options to bring back to the legislature.
Thank you, Commissioner Jessen. And to the earlier part of your question, Representative Drazkowski and Representative Pearson both have bills that look at trying to get at more accountability and program integrity, both through verification of payment for devices, for medications, and for services, as well as for eligibility with their two bills. So those are moving through the committee. They will be in this committee, and we're also excited about the opportunity for some real savings based on what they have seen in other states through similar techniques. And we've attempted this in the past in Minnesota, and we've gotten some success, but also I think there's an appetite for a more robust look at that and to get some actual savings as other states have had. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Jessen, on page 94, talking about the care facilities, and while I don't represent Fergus Falls is on the other side of my district, and so I have been in communication with them. And I'm just wondering if you could review with the committee what your plan is for that. Fergus Falls is going to be closed. That's your plan, is to close it by January 1st of 2017. I believe that there was a six-month extension, but Otter Tail doesn't believe that that is long enough for them to find a private company to take over. Plus, there's the concern about the lease, that the state said that they would enter in a lease with Fergus Falls, and the state of Minnesota is not going to uphold their end of the bargain with that lease. I believe it was a 25-year lease. That's, in the year 20-something or other that it's supposed to be up.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, now on the terms of the lease agreement, I just don't have those details as I sit here. I believe Deputy Commissioner Ann Berry is here. I'm happy to have her, if you like, Mr. Chair, and can take the time to answer the lease questions.
She could probably answer that. Thanks for coming down, Commissioner Berry. Please come down and introduce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ann Berry, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We usually enter into shorter-term leases when we lease buildings, so we do not have a 25-year lease on this building. I believe we have a lease for that lasts maybe another year, if at the most 2 years. Generally, when we don't own the property, we do not enter into long-term leases. Otter Tail County has explained to us that they believe they built this at the state's request. That was before my time or the commissioner's time with the department. We've asked for documentation to support that and have not received any yet.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I think that the lease information is incorrect. That they've been telling me that it was that in the 20-year range. I have everything upstairs in my office. So what information have you been asking for that you have not been able to get?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we'd be happy to get any information from Otter Tail County about the commitment that was made by the state when the building was bonded for by the county in 2000, I believe, was the time frame. So at that time frame, you know, we were closing down the facilities, and that was happening in a number of communities. So we don't have any information in the department about any commitment that the state made over the long term for using that facility. And we've asked the county, and in fact, I'm going next week to meet with the county board, and we'll ask for that information again.
Okay.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If they are unable to find a outside party to take over the facility, are you able to extend that beyond the current 6-month extension that has been given?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen. I mean, this is a proposal in the governor's budget, and you know, I think this would be over a year and a half from now that we would be proposing to close Fergus Falls. And the reason we extended it and we put the Fergus closure out so far is we want to see, frankly, how this plays out. You know, we don't want to leave people without services they need. And so while we, based upon our conversations with providers and others, believe that there are a lot of these folks that can be served in private facilities, where we want to make sure with a higher rate that that is happening and possible before we move to close Fergus Falls. So from our perspective, we'd be looking, you know, certainly at the community needs, but very much also at the client needs, and are we able to serve them other places? We really, I think, in both Wilmer and Fergus, hope to just have more extensive conversations with the community, you know, and the providers in those areas. I was out at Wilmer last week, and going to Fergus. So we see this as the beginning of a conversation.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to just respond to some of the comments from Representative Grunhagen about the OLA report. And obviously, this is something that's of great importance to all of us. And Representative Grunhagen, I know you're not on the Health HHS Reform Committee, so you missed our extensive conversation on this on Friday. But really, Mr. Nobles didn't spend the money that he was allocated because he didn't do the work that he was asked to do. And the reason he didn't do it wasn't really his fault. He tried sincerely to do it, but he was not able to hire an outside firm that we had directed him to do because the language in the direction to him was too restrictive. So We have language now that was put together by him, by his staff, as well as working with DHS. And there is a bill, and there's also an amendment that is added to Representative Dean's bill now. And it changes it so that he would, under the new language, be able to do the work we asked him to do. And so I think that before we celebrate too much about his returning the money, you know, when you send somebody to the grocery store to buy a bunch of groceries and they come home with a candy bar and give you back the rest of the money, you don't say, this is great, you didn't spend the money because you needed the groceries. And that's kind of the situation we're in, I think, with Mr. Nobles. So, you know, I just want to, I know, Representative Grunhagen, that you're going to be interested in what we're trying to do because I think you share the goals. And I just wanted to caution you about that point because in this proposal that the commissioner is here talking to us about, she's the governor's recommending that we spend some money to hire some more auditors to do this work that I know that you are very interested in, and that is making sure that the money that we give the HMOs to buy health care for our public program recipients, that that money is really going to health care, that it's really being spent for what it's supposed to be spent for. And those, that's the real-time or ad hoc audits that I was asking about previously. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention because that's, a key issue. And I think it's great that members are concerned about making sure we're not wasting dollars with eligibility issues and all these things. That's all important. But we're spending billions with the HMOs to deliver these programs, and we've just got to audit that appropriately both through the OLA and through DHS to make sure that money really is going where we think it's going.
And members, we do have, we went through quite a discussion on this in policy committee that will be re-referred tomorrow, that bill, and move along. So I'm sure we'll have more discussion on this. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you.
Lane has the last question.
Yep. Ms. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen, Representative Lane is next.
Oh.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, I think we're actually talking about three totally different kind of audits. And the one that the OLA did that he presented to us was one that came on. The list that we're putting together now as to what the legislature would like to have the OLA audit, and then we will get a checkoff and we will choose, and on that basis he will have his orders as to what to do. And one of those in the past was the administrative costs of the HMOs, the managed care organizations, and that was what he was reported on, administrative costs. He also mentioned that this bill that went through, this is another audit altogether, to do medical costs in the past and to report on how that went, and do we really know, did we actually do it correctly in what we allocated to them. And that was going to go very deep and very independent, and nobody could be doing that who had done work for the state, so it was very restrictive and very serious and very expensive. And he could not find a person that was that independent that could do it, so therefore it wasn't done. It has now been, as Representative Lieberman mentioned, loosened up so that he can access some people to do that. But a third one that's been presented here now is the department themselves doing something in-house and real-time. And they need more FTEs to actually do that. I like the idea of a real-time and in-house. Saves the profit that may go to an outside firm. I just hope that it can be also independent, and that's what I'll be trusting.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Just very quickly. Yeah, I talked to Mr. Nobles directly. We also had him testify at a committee I was at. He clearly said that he was given the $1.7 million. He didn't need it. He did it in-house. And that his intent was to return $1.6 million back to the general fund, which he's last I talked to him, he said he was having difficulty doing. So I will have to agree to disagree on that point. I think Mr. Noble sets an excellent example of, in, you know, 16 years on the school board and 5 years up here, I've never seen one agency or department return money back to the general fund. Now, maybe they have, and I'm not aware of it, but I just thought Mr. Noble's testimony at the committee I was at was noteworthy, and I did talk to him quite a bit about it afterwards.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Thank you for all the folks that came in to present the governor's supplemental budget. We are going to be receiving our budget target today. We will be talking about that in Ways and Means. That will begin our budget discussions and probably a lot of committee time in the next phase here. So look forward to lots of ideas and input from folks. And so our committee administrator and committee legislative assistant are ready, willing, and able to take all information. And please keep that open communication as we go into the next week. I'm sure we'll have lots of questions and ideas as we move forward. And ideas are good and needed and appreciated at this time. So with that, members, we are adjourned.